U.S. v. Watson. Mr. McGowan.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Andrew J. McGowan. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois, and I represent the appellant, Mr. Willie Watson, in this case. Both Mr. Watson and Mr. Redmond have raised the appeal of the District Court's failure to set a repayment schedule for restitution, and I will be addressing that issue for both defendants. Of course, as this Court's well aware, either by the government's letter or by actual participation, this issue is before the Court in other cases. In all of those cases, there's really no question whether it's error or whether it's something that the Court has already decided. The question is, should the Court change course based on a similar issue, whether drug testing should have been ordered by the Court? Since it's been briefed in other cases at some length, and since it's been adequately briefed in this case, unless the Court has any questions, I intend to rest on the brief.
I think that's fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a long way to travel for that period. Sure, Larry. We'll see on case five or so.
Good morning. My name is Gareth Morris. I represent Anthony Redmond. I am only going to speak to one issue because Mr. McGowan's handled the first issue. The fourth issue that had to do with, really, I raised the issue that Rita decided against me. And second issue is it was simply to preserve the argument that Lopez goes too far, that the effect on interstate commerce has to be more than just de minimis for it to be constitutional. The indictment specifically alleges on the first page that the bank's handling of paper U.S. currency affected interstate commerce. And then over the page says, and the currency Davis Bancorp delivered, that's the armored truck that was robbed, the currency Davis Bancorp delivered to the bank by armored car traveled in interstate commerce. Well, those allegations are irrelevant to the question of whether or not there was proof of an effect on interstate commerce, because the Peterson case that decided in 2001, 236 Federal 3rd, 848, says that the fact that this currency is robbed doesn't meet the Commerce Clause requirement because every robbery, or most of them, involve taking money. So then the government's response is, well, that's not what we proved. But the government did put on evidence about the source of the funds, which was the Federal Reserve. Over and over again in questions and answers, the Federal Reserve is mentioned. And, in fact, there was evidence that the bank was an FDIC-insured bank. At first, you would say, well, that's not... Perhaps you would suggest that mentioning Federal Reserve doesn't indicate a reference to currency traveling in interstate commerce. But I notice that if you look at every single bill in your pocket, it says right across the top, Federal Reserve note. So there was substantial evidence that by referring to Federal Reserve, which had no purpose, the government was presenting evidence to support the allegation in the indictment that currency traveled in interstate commerce. Therefore, commerce had been affected, and therefore there was a basis for the jury's general verdict that there was a violation of the Hobbs Act.
Who owned the money?
Pardon?
Who owned the money? The bank?
It was being delivered to the bank, and I think at the point where they received it, they would then own it. And until then...
Because if the bank owned the money, then don't you think the Hobbs Act is satisfied, interstate? I mean, think of all the de minimis connection to interstate commerce that there has to be in a case.
I don't think so. First of all, the bank didn't. I mean, I know that's quarreling with the hypothesis, but it didn't, and it had no claim against its insurance carrier after it was stolen. The claim was made by the armored car company. But the mere fact of having currency taken from you does not meet the standard, and Peterson stands squarely for that. The second problem with the verdict is the instruction, which was objected to, which really is contradictory. It says, and this is at, it's in the docket at number 132, it's on page 24, and Judge Connelly gave it at, in the transcript at 735. It begins properly by saying, with respect to count two, the government must prove that the actions of the particular defendant you are considering affected interstate commerce in any way or degree. But then at the end it says, it's not necessary you find the particular defendant you are considering knew or intended that his actions would affect interstate commerce or that there was an actual effect on interstate commerce. Now, I think that's immensely confusing. I've read it over and over again, and it seems to me the last sentence directly contradicts the first sentence, and the jury's left with a question about whether there has to be an actual effect on interstate commerce or not. So that erroneous instruction, taken in conjunction with evidence that because the money traveled in interstate commerce, that means it was affected, the commerce was affected, leads to the conclusion that there's a faulty basis for the verdict.
Well, there was proof, I think you've conceded, that with regard to the vehicle, the bulletproof vest, other items involved in the facts of this robbery, travel in interstate commerce.
That is correct, Your Honor. We concede that there is evidence of the depletion of assets theory, I think because we had to, there was. But Peterson says, where a verdict rests on any of several grounds, one of which was improper, the conviction cannot be upheld.
But the government didn't argue that alternative theory to the jury, did they, in closing argument?
No.
You're right that they presented evidence of these funds and the cash funds and moving, but, I mean, that was not argued to the jury. The only theory they argued was depletion of assets.
Right.
And they argued that the evidence they provided satisfied the depletion of assets theory and was covered by the instruction. And that fit the elements of the instruction.
I think that's correct.
So then the jury, I agree, you know, I understand your argument that they could interpret it differently, but there was certainly no meat put on the bones by any counsel in terms of arguing it. And you didn't argue that they failed under this alternative theory, did you?
No.
Trial counsel did not argue. All I'm saying is it wasn't even in the game for purposes of closing argument and for purposes of the trial.
I think that's fair, except that the indictment was sent back to the jury and then this evidence was put on. And, in fact, even the indictment's erroneous because it confuses that something travels in interstate commerce, which is not the test under the Hobbs Act, with affected interstate commerce, which is the test. But I see I've got a bright red light, so I'll sit down. Thank you.
Ms. Lockett.
Angela Lockett, the Law Office of Standish Willis for the defendant, Tracy Redman. I'm going to address the issue of the admittance of the hearsay, Rule 804b3. In this case, the judge let in hearsay statements of Anthony Redman that went against Tracy Redman. And these statements, the one that we are challenging, Tracy Redman says, quote, "I don't know what's going on, but I mean, you know, like when I told Doe," he was like, "No, they can't identify me." This is a statement that Anthony Redman attributes to Tracy Redman. Our argument is that the statement was not trustworthy because Anthony Redman, at the time he made the statement, had a reason to lie to the person whom he was talking to, who was co-defendant Estella Suttle. And according to U.S. v. Westmoreland, in order for a statement to be admitted under 804b3, the declarant must be unavailable, the statement must be against their penal interests, and cooperating circumstances must bolster the trustworthiness of the statement. And the Supreme Court has said in Williamson v. United States that each statement must get its own consideration. So the statement has to be looked at not in the context of the whole narrative, but into that statement specifically. We argue that the statement was not against his penal interest in that he begins it by saying he doesn't know what's going on. So he's taking himself out of the facts of what he's saying. And secondly, we argue that the circumstances show that Mr. Anthony Redman had a reason to lie at the time because he told this person who he was speaking with, Estella Thuttle, that he was not involved in the robbery, that he was not there when the robbery happened, and that because he wanted not to give her her proceeds of the robbery. But according to another co-defendant, Willie Watson, he was there.
And, so, and remind me, in this conversation that they had, was there any discussion before he made the statements or afterwards about her cut?
No, there was no conversation about her cut of the money in terms of this conversation. They had spoken previously where, according to Stella Suttle, he told her that he didn't go on the robbery, so he didn't get a greater share. He's going to ask Tracy to see if he can get her some money. She was promised $20,000. According to her, she only got $5,000 from the robbery. So at the time Anthony Ridman is talking to Stella Suttle, his words can't be trusted because he's been lying to her previously and presumably at this point also. The error in this case wasn't harmless because the evidence against Tracy Ridman in this case consisted of the statements of co-defendants Willie Watson and Stella Suttle, which are always suspect. Then also, the only other evidence was evidence of purchase of some vehicles, but the government claims that his brother was involved in a robbery of $400,000, so that couldn't be conclusive. And there was no physical evidence tying Tracy Ridman to this crime whatsoever, but there was physical evidence against Anthony Ridman, the person who is making these statements that were introduced, which bolster what he says. In terms of the Crawford analysis...
So go back to the car. I thought he actually bought one of the cars.
Well, he has a car in his name, and there was a car in his sister's name, and they were attributed to him. But even if the car was in his name, there's no saying where that money came from. His brother was alleged to have gotten $400,000. So there's no saying that that means that he stole the money because his brother got $400,000. And also another family member had a car in their name. So their family, in terms of that being conclusive as to his guilt, I don't think is strong enough to survive a harmless error analysis.
Okay, but there was one car that he purchased in his name with cash a few days after the robbery.
Yes, ma'am. The 804B3 is not a firmly rooted hearsay exception to the extent that the Supreme Court in Davis v. Washington says that the Crawford analysis only applies to testimonial statements. We haven't argued that this was testimonial in nature and that Anthony Ridman didn't realize he was being taped at the time. But the evidence still should have some indice of reliability. And in this terms, him talking to Estella Suttle, when he has lied to her previously, he has a reason to lie to her when he's talking, it's not trustworthy enough to be admitted into evidence against Tracy Ridman. And so, thank you, Alan.
All right, thank you.
Now we'll hear from the government.
May it please the court, my name is Renato Mariotti and I represent the United States in this appeal. The first issue before the court is whether the district court's judgment ordering restitution payments to begin immediately is reversible plain error. And like the appellant, I'll rest on our brief unless the court has any additional questions on that. Regarding the issue of whether or not there was a sufficient proof of the interstate commerce element, first of all, this court has held repeatedly that a de minimis or other slight effect on interstate commerce is sufficient. The district court's the district court's instruction, therefore, wasn't erroneous to say that there didn't need to be an actual effect on commerce. As a matter of fact, that was actually quoting a holding of this court in Ray. Furthermore, as the appellant conceded, the government did present sufficient evidence under the depletion of assets theory. The armored car company is an interstate company that operates in Wisconsin, Indiana, and Florida. Evidence from the armored car company, from a witness from the armored car company, the witness said that there was a $20,000 deductible that was paid on the insurance, and the witness also testified that the company purchased items in interstate commerce.
So let's move then to the more difficult problem, because the fact is that the indictment says that the cash moved in interstate commerce, and that's not a permissible basis under the Hobbs Act, right?
That's right, Your Honor, although that wasn't, as Your Honor noted in questioning earlier, that wasn't what the government argued in its closing argument.
But you agree it's an impermissible basis for Hobbs Act jurisdiction.
That's right, Your Honor. Although the district court did give an instruction that the indictment is not evidence and shouldn't be relied upon by the jury, and the district court's instruction itself on interstate commerce element was proper.
Well, what do you have any case law that says that a jury cannot, or suggests that a jury couldn't have possibly convicted under an impermissible theory just because the government focused on another theory at trial?
No, Your Honor, although I don't think that is the question here, or I don't think that's the issue here. I mean, the question is whether or not, certainly it's possible that juries can make a decision based on evidence that they draw inferences from, but the question is what the instructions were that were given to the jury, what evidence was presented to the jury, and the instructions. The government didn't argue or put forth evidence of the cash moving in interstate commerce, other than the text of the indictment, which the court clearly instructed was not evidence, and the district court instructed the jurors that they should be deciding this based on a depletion of assets theory, gave an appropriate instruction, and there was substantial evidence that the government referenced in closing, which supported that, and which appellant concedes is sufficient under that theory. I think that's enough under proof of interstate commerce.
So bottom line is you don't really have a case on point. You're just arguing the facts to support your theory.
That's right, Your Honor.
Okay.
Regarding the admission of Anthony's statements against Tracy Redmond, first of all, as the government noted in its brief, this argument's been waived because Tracy Redmond didn't provide the transcript containing the district court's opinion in his appendix. Furthermore, this issue wasn't briefed or argued below, so any review by this court should be under a plain error standard. Anthony's statements against Tracy should come in under Westmoreland. Anthony Redmond clearly revealed his inside knowledge of the crime in these statements. He said, and I'm going to quote, he says, "I'm saying the whole face was covered, you know, his hair was up in his hat, he had his hat up over his face, you know, they can't identify him by his face." He wasn't saying that Tracy told him that, he was saying that he said that himself. This is what he said. He also said that he mentioned an armored car company, which Suttle didn't bring up in the conversation at all. He knew that this was the armored car company. And this was this conversation that's been focused on in this argument by appellant is actually the second of two conversations. In the first conversation, Suttle contacts Redmond and starts mentioning news reports he saw, and Redmond acts as if he knew exactly what she was talking about. And then after that discussion, immediately calls Tracy Redmond. The government introduced an agent who testified that the call log showed just a minute later he calls Tracy about it, which is an independent initiative suggesting that there is some truth to the fact that he knew about this crime.
Well, so, you agree that in the conversation with Suttle, he was trying to distance himself from the robbery, at least initially, when he was saying he didn't know about things. I mean, he was attempting to do that in the conversation.
He did it. It's sort of contradictory. At one point in the conversation, he does, and another point when he's trying to assure, he's like, "Look, I saw it. I saw his face. It was covered by the hat. You couldn't see anything."
So in terms of the trustworthiness, even though he was lying about his involvement, you think it's safe to trust other parts of the statement he made?
Well, I think,
but
it
as
was,
you said, it's some yes, some no.
I think it was reasonable for the jury and for the district judge to determine, based on this statement, that there was enough indicia that it was reliable, Your Honor. I think, first of all, the fact that he mentioned the armored car company without it being brought up, the fact that he knew what this robbery was about and without any prompting from Suttle whatsoever, didn't question, what are you talking, you know, or if someone who wasn't involved was asked, well, what are you talking about? I didn't, you know, that wasn't his first reaction. His first reaction is that he knew about this crime and he knew exactly what she was talking about. And then at a long portion of this transcript, he says, look, I saw, you know, he didn't say that, I don't want to mislead Your Honor, but he says, you know, that the hat was this way, the mask was this way. It's enough for a district court or a jury to believe that or conclude that Redmond himself was making those observations himself. The only other issue I think that was raised was the constitutionality of the Hobbs Act. This court's repeatedly found that the Hobbs Act is constitutional irrespective of Lopez and Morrison. And if there's no other questions on that or on anything else, I'll rest.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
McGowan? Oh. Mr. Morris. Mr. McGowan is pressed on his brief, right? Right.
Proof of de minimis effect on interstate commerce doesn't mean proof of no actual effect. Counsel just said that the law is that you don't have to prove an effect. Well, you certainly do. And so why would they prove an effect if it wasn't required? It is an impermissible basis to prove the effect on interstate commerce by talking about the currency. And tellingly, in the government's brief at page 28, in discussing whether or not it's possible the jury was relying on an improper basis, the government says, however, there is little or no risk that the jury relied on this basis to find the interstate commerce element. Well, a risk that maybe they entirely relied on something that isn't appropriate or lawful is not a finding beyond a reasonable doubt. And the Peterson case directly deals with this very fact, where you have sort of the three supports for the stool, and the court doesn't even get to the third one. It says, well, proof of currency doesn't proof of currency traveling in interstate commerce isn't sufficient to support the verdict, and proof that the marijuana that was stolen, because this was a crime against a drug dealer, and the question was whether the drug dealer was in interstate commerce, proof that the marijuana maybe was from out of state, but wasn't certainly from out of state, was insufficient. So the court said, well, we're not going to even look at the third one, which had to do with guns traveling. Lastly, to answer Judge Evans' earlier question, now that I've had at least a moment to think about it, if the currency belonged to the bank, was stolen, there's a different jurisdictional standard there, because there's FDIC insurance, which and that's the connection to commerce. You now have a federal government program that's impacted by taking the bank's money. And the government suggests that by at least presenting evidence of it, when, again, it's not a proper basis.
Well, if it was the bank's money, they could have charged just a Hobbs Act bank robbery.
It would be a bank robbery. That's correct.
Right.
And here, and one of the reasons that was argued energetically below that this was not a federal case, that it was really just a robbery, is because it wasn't a bank robbery. It was a robbery of $400,000 being in the hands of an armored truck company.
See, if you concede, though, that it was the bank's money and then you won, would you have to be retried? Would that a retrial violate double jeopardy? Because you have a different element now.
I think it's a different crime. I think it's a different statute and a different crime.
So you concede then that you could be recharged with robbing the bank's money, taking money from the bank.
I'm always loath to concede that my client can be prosecuted, but I think that you're right.
Because that's why in these cases, interstate commerce connection is usually kind of a throwaway issue. I grant it's not in this case, but it generally is. If it was the bank's money, then this could have been recharged as a robbery of the bank. They took the money that belonged to the bank, and the bank's federally insured and all that.
Well, it's difficult because there are these different ways in which federal jurisdiction attaches under the Commerce Clause. And so for a gun charge, it's that the gun itself traveled in interstate commerce. For this offense, it's that there's an effect, which is different. And in fact, Peterson lays out these three standards under Lopez, three different ways. And so I think the jury was confused, too. I think this instruction is very confusing. It's not far off the patent instruction, Seventh Circuit instruction, but I think the first sentence saying there has to be a proof of effect, and the last sentence that says it doesn't have to be, particularly then when the government says, gee, you don't even have to prove effect, I think it's extremely confusing to the jury, and I'm sure they didn't understand whether it was the currency or other factors.
See, I might be wrong, but I don't think a jury spends a lot of time on an issue like that. They're concerned about was the guy in the mask who was being put down by the insider, Ms. Suttle, and the getaway car driver, are they testifying falsely against him to save their own skin? That's what the jury is considering.
I agree. This was a dramatic and a terrible crime, and this is a technical but an important issue because the federal court has no jurisdiction to even proceed if there's no connection to interstate commerce.
Did I understand you to say that the pattern instruction was used but modified?
Yes, I believe it, that last sentence, the one that I'm picking on, is different. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Lockett.
First, let me address counsel's argument in terms of waiving the 804B3 issue. As we stated in our brief, we did order transcripts. I've ordered them twice. It's an oversight that they're not here. I do anticipate you all will have them before you begin your deliberations. I will hope that my client wouldn't be penalized for that. In terms of us waiving it, that we didn't argue it at the district court level, we did file a response to the motion in limine where we challenged these statements based on the fact that they did not meet the 804B3 standards and also that they weren't admissible under Crawford. Under Crawford, the statements must bear an adequate indicia of reliability. So we have argued both the reliability and under that they warrant statements against interest. In terms of the government's argument, what they're doing is they're looking at the entire narrative. They're taking everything that he said and saying this is why it's a statement against interest. Under Williamson, that each statement must be adequately analyzed on its own. The statement that we're challenging is the one where he says, I don't know what's going on, but you know, like when I told Doe, he was like, no, he can't identify me. He is making statement that he attributes to Doe, and it was brought out in trial that Doe referred to Tracy Redmond. In terms of the other statements, when he's saying he had his hat covered or his hair wasn't showing, there was no mention of whoever it was that he was talking about at that time. At this time, he is clearly saying what Doe allegedly said to him. And we argue that that wasn't against his penal interest and that it wasn't reliable and that you have to look at each statement by itself and not just the whole narrative because that wouldn't, it's not a narrative against interest, it's a statement against interest.